We'll get going. Good morning, I can still say, for 10 minutes. My name is Clemens. I work for Microsoft. I work in a Redmond team. So my team is in the USA, but I work out of my house in Germany most of the time, and then I travel there. So I have a very long way to work, and I do that with an airplane. And so I don't have to do that every day. I only do that every 2 months for about 1.5 weeks. That's when I'm with my team, and otherwise I'm either at home or sometimes I'm also with people like you to talk about the things that we're building. And so in the next 57 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about Windows Azure Service Bus, and I'm going to talk about a number of interesting scenarios around messaging and how you can use messaging in the cloud, but also on the server with technology that we're building for you. And I have another session at 15:30. I'm going to talk about this from a hybrid application angle. There's going to be a little bit of overlap between those two, but not too much. And also, not only hello to everybody in the room, but also to the millions and millions at the TV screens at home, obviously. So, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you have a wonderful opportunity to do that now, because that's my handle, Clemens V. I tweet things that matter and don't matter. And you will find information about German football, about aviation and big airplanes, and, of course, about Windows Azure, if you follow me. So if you're interested in any of those three things, that might be an interesting thing to do. What I'll talk about in terms of messaging is I'm going to focus mostly around the technologies that we have in Windows Azure Service Bus, but also in Windows Server Service Bus. The scope for this is fairly broad. The technology that we're building is for integrating systems irrespective of what platform they run on, irrespective of where they are, and integrating them either with the cloud or through the cloud. And for that, we have a number of capabilities in the system. So we have connected appliances or devices. We have on Service Bus today a very broad variety of things already, where we have vehicles that are connected through Service Bus into the cloud. We have kitchen appliances that are connected through Service Bus into the cloud. And we also obviously have phones and tablets, we have PCs and servers, we have SaaS cloud applications, line of business applications, and we have SharePoint sites, and we have a number of different kinds of scenarios. I'm going to walk you through some of those scenarios today. The artifacts we have in Service Bus, in that part of the cloud platform, is queues and topics, which allow you to do publish, subscribe. I'm going to talk about those. We have relays. I'm going to demo that because it's kind of hard to explain without you seeing it. We have notifications. I'm going to talk about those too. That's a new capability that we built specifically for mobile platforms, tablets, phones, and how we can help you to scale out. And that's something where we're really excited about particular sporting events, for instance, also, that will take a dependency on that. So, what is Service Bus? Service Bus is a cloud or self-hosted middleware that you can either buy from us to run in the cloud, and you can use this in Windows Azure even if you don't run things straight inside of Windows Azure. You could use Service Bus theoretically even if your applications were running in, let's say, Amazon EC2. It is cloud-hosted messaging middleware. Two additions. One is the Windows Azure Service Bus. That's always the newest version of this. So we develop cloud first. So everything that we do, and this goes out in at least quarterly, sometimes every six weeks, new features that we're bringing in. Fixes are actually coming in on a very regular schedule of about 2 weeks. And we have multiple clusters in each data centers. We have 8 data centers currently active around the world. We have made some announcements for Windows Azure that we're going to add 6 more data centers. It will be in all of those data centers as well. So you can go and pick where you want to have your what we call Service Bus namespace. That's what these entities are in, and you can make many namespaces across those data centers. So you can go and set up a global footprint very easily. And we'll run this service bus infrastructure for you at 99.9% availability SLA. SLA means service level agreement. That's what we guarantee that we'll give you. Factually, what we run at is the relay runs at 99.98% 99.98% maybe. And the messaging system runs slightly below that at 99.97%, but that's a very high, very good reputable numbers for a messaging infrastructure that you can rely on. We do everything in, no downtime upgrades. We'll never announce a servicing window because servicing happens just as the normal course of events. If you want to run this yourself, you can. There's a download you can get. You can go to downloads.microsoft.com and you can get Service Bus for Windows Server 1.0. That's a free download and it's licensed together with Windows Server. And the minimal requirement for storage is SQL Express. So we're sitting on top of the SQL storage engine with Service Bus because that gives us a number of additional capabilities like replication and backup and all those things. So we didn't have to build them ourselves. So we used the SQL storage engine for that. And you can start at SQL Server Express, but you can go up to a SQL 2012 build always on cluster. If you were hosting this on a very fat machine, like a 16-way machine, 24 gigs of RAM, and you also do the same thing for a SQL database, you can get up to 25,000 messages per second out of a queue. So it's a very capable messaging system. It's really only gated by the available IOPS, and it's usually, in all of our testing, it's completely bound by I/O. So we don't peg CPU there yet. We have a very, very efficient system, which effectively scales up as you scale up your hardware, and also scales out for failover to 3 nodes. So clustering is built into Service Bus, the Service Bus system that you can go and download. That is largely symmetric with the version that we have in the cloud, but it is the SDK 1.8 is symmetric, up to 1.8 is symmetric with cloud and on-premises. The newest SDK that we just put out for the cloud version is already 2 steps ahead of the server that we've shipped, which we shipped half a year ago. And so that SDK is no longer compatible, so you have to stick with the 1.8 SDK if you want to target both. And as we roll out new versions of Windows later this year, that's not a big secret, there will also be an update to this, to the server, so that you can then go and get new features that I'll be talking about today also in the server version. But we do everything cloud first. That's why the server version is always a little bit lagging. Let's talk about some key customer scenarios, because scenarios is one of the key aspects of this talk. The first one is around building cloud services. So you build applications that are purely living inside a cloud-based systems. What you need messaging for is to decouple pieces from each other. So you have a front end that takes orders from the web, and you have a back end that processes these orders. You want to make sure that the front end doesn't put too much stress on that back end. So a good way to decouple this is using a queue. And also pops up. I'm going to go and go through all these examples in more detail. The second big scenario group that we see is enable hybrid configurations. Hybrid is when you already have things that are running in a system in your data center. And here I use data center very loosely. Data center could be a machine under someone's desk. If you are a very small company, that's your data center. It might be a bunch of racks in the corner. That's also a data center, or it may be a proper, closed, proper facility that you run because you're a large company. But if you have any assets that are sitting on premises and you want to enhance them with cloud services in some way, or you want to bridge to a cloud service, so you want to keep those things running on premises and you want to do some functions in the cloud, you need to create a bridge to go and integrate those services. And that's what hybrid means, and we see a lot of use in hybrid scenarios, and I'll talk about that too. And then lastly, and that's something that we see more and more, and that's where I invest currently effectively 100% of my time in, is connected client scenarios. Support applications that need to notify devices, for instance. So if you are building, it's actually a very interesting topic. If you're building a Windows 8 application, or you're building a Windows Phone application, or you're building an iOS application, you can do that mostly without using a server or services. You can do a lot of things on those devices. Now, once you add certain features like push notifications, where you now want to notify everybody of certain events that are happening, you now need to have a server application. You actually need to have a very scalable one if your application is very successful. Let's say you are hitting a big success and you're selling, you know, available for download like 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 copies of your application. And now you want to go and push a notification to all those devices. That's a big job, because now you need to manage 200,000 records. They change all the time. That's all a big job. And so we think doing that big job for you is something that you will appreciate. So we'll help with this. And then connected client scenarios, there's this bullet here, which is not on the slide, but I kind of in my mind, is in the next, and that was something that was talked about in the keynote. Jonas talked about this. In 2020, there will be 50 billion connected devices, from the toaster to the car to a train. Everything will be connected in one way or another. How do you connect those things? If you are, let's say you are working for a company that's making laundry washing machines, and you want to internet enable those, and you'll say, why would I do this? Well, you want to know how the machine does, you want to know when you can send out service, you want to know when the machine breaks. There's all kinds of reasons why you do this. And you're shipping hundreds of thousands of these machines worldwide every year. How do you connect all those? Those companies are specialists in doing washing machines, but they're not specialists in building scale-out systems. So we're thinking about how we can help those folks who we have a great relationship to as Microsoft, how we can help those. And if you are a partner of Microsoft, we will want you to enable to build solutions for that. So let's talk about some scenarios in more concrete ways. The first one I want to talk about is Halo 4. Who has played Halo? A few. So Halo is a game that we sell for Xbox, and it's one of the biggest game franchises in the world. And it's a really great game, and you should all go and buy it. But what do we do with Service Bus? So the Halo team has built a brand new set of experiences that allows the players to have a more of a career, more of a pervasive experience. So there's an application you can download for all major platforms: iOS, Android, Windows Phone. And also Windows, which is Halo Waypoint. And Halo Waypoint is kind of your career dashboard for Halo. And if you are a Halo player, and if you're into that universe, you will want to follow your career, and actually your scores, your points matter. If you are a 16-year-old boy, that's the biggest thing in the world. So what they do out of their multiplayer games, where you can shoot each other, the results are being collected and they're being forwarded into the statistics warehouse of Halo. And that's just as serious as a data warehouse for a company. And people are just as keen about their points as they are about money. So they need to go and collect all that data, need to go and put that up into the statistics, into this Halo Waypoint app. When you play an Xbox game, the Xbox Live Network is a peer-to-peer mesh that's running on top of a protocol that's similar to IPsec, but it's proprietary to Xbox. At the edge of that network sit gateways, and those gateways are put up by the game publisher. So Halo has an edge server, or a set of edge servers, on that protected network. From there, They send the data into service bus queues. They have up to 500 queues to do that because of the peak traffic. And then they go to the Halo backend roles, which do the processing, and then go to Xbox Live. Why would they use a queue? Well, it turns out if the Halo backend role is not available, if it's not there, if they need to go and service it, because all that traffic goes into service bus is there and it's more higher available, so they can go and take their system offline for a short while and put it online again, and the messages are still there. That's point one. Point two is they get a lot of very spiky traffic in the evening when a lot of people are playing, and then during the day it's not so much. So the traffic kind of goes in waves. So that the highest traffic spikes, we're taking them. So they go into service bus, and then the backend roles don't have to go and be scaled for peak, but they have to be scaled for just median traffic. So that's one. That's how Halo is using us. And Halo, what's interesting about Halo from a scale perspective is if you think about how a normal application scales, or the scale needs are over time, right? You have the scale axis, the time axis. A normal application starts kind of at low and then kind of goes up like this. If you're selling a game, a console game, and you're selling it through a store, and you're selling a game like Halo, you're selling a million copies on the first day, in the first 2 hours that it is on the market. So their scale time, their scale axis starts here, right, in the first week, goes up higher, and then tapers off over time. They have to be ready on the first day. SimCity, anybody? SimCity came out, had a wonderful new DRM system, didn't test for scale, everything collapsed, everybody was unhappy. That shouldn't happen to you. So having something that can actually take that load is something is very useful. Turns out Halo was down, that system was down on day one. Nobody knew because all the traffic went to the service bus, and service bus kind of rescued that show because it was there. Second example, we have actually by now several retail services, ISVs, who are using service bus to connect point of sale systems. Point of sale system means cash register in stores. We have a wonderful company, very small company in Italy that we're working with, and we have a very much larger company in Israel. And they're doing about the same pattern, both. The points of sales are effectively points of sale systems of whatever form that are sitting in a shop. And as goods are being sold, the receipts effectively are being sent through a service bus queue into a set of web services which are living out in the cloud, and they do analysis of all kinds of sorts. So they analyze what the stream of goods is that goes out. They analyze what people are paying, what are people buying together, all kinds of analysis things, and the results of that get then published into a service bus topic, from which they can be pulled out through subscriptions into various functions, IT admin for monitoring, and marketing to actually get the business value out of this. What this creates is a real-time insight into the data stream, into the sales process as it happens. So now all of these things are instantly connected. Not only that, but also there's a back channel that can be established here, and that's what they're also using. So let's say marketing starts a radio campaign, and a radio campaign is something that we can get fairly immediate feedback over. So they start a radio campaign, and what they do is they start the campaign and say, this wonderful piece of clothing now only costs 1,600 rubles. So it's now it's super cheap, go and buy it. What they can do from the marketing side is they can now update from there all the cash registers to actually have the correct price. They don't have to telegraph anybody. They can basically just set the price, and that gets distributed to all the cash registers. They can now also analyze whether the radio campaign and that price drop actually has the desired effect, and they can do that in real time. So that enables them to do that, and now you have a distributed system that goes across all those shops, which is very interesting. And you do that purely through messaging. There's no VPN. There's none of that complicated setup. The only thing that that is required is that the points of sale have an internet connection. That's all you need. No VPN, no complication. Then we have several cases where we have enterprise services ISVs who are connecting between different places that they have, and they connect through the cloud. So we have companies who have assets in their own enterprise data center, and then they have customers who also have a data center or an application running, and they bridge between those places through the cloud. We have that in many incarnations. We have one case where we have a company which sells, or actually rents, DVDs in America, and they do that, actually in that case in Canada, and they have machines, vending machines, that are sitting outside of drugstores, and you can go and walk up to that machine, and you can go and get a DVD out, and you can bring it back tomorrow, and that costs you $1. You can also pre-order over the web from your machine on your way from work to home. You could order a DVD. The way that works is you go to the website, and the website will tell you which DVDs are actually in that box outside of your drugstore, and you can go and reserve one. So there you actually integrate directly with, you go from the website and you poke directly into that box and you reserve something in that box. That link is also done through Service Bus. So here you have a private place and another private place. That company runs their own data center and they have their own private place, but they're linking them through the cloud. So much for some scenarios. I'm going to skip this one because I'm going to show you that later. So, from the capabilities perspective, I'm going to go through the things that we have. So I'm going to start with the relay. The relay is something I'm going to show you first in a little demo. So I have here a program. Let's go to make this a little bigger. And that program is a very normal application. It's a WCF web service. So using the Windows Communication Foundation's REST capabilities, we're going to have that same capability also for Web API shortly, sometime this summer. It's actually done, but it's we are just figuring some things out in addition. So you're creating a web service host, and it's hosting an image service. We're going to take a look at that in a moment. And then we add in configuration an endpoint to this. So this is the configuration to this. And the configuration, if you're familiar with the Windows Communication Foundation, is actually very normal. We have a service, we have an endpoint, and we define which contract that's using. And the binding is a fairly normal binding. The web HTTP binding is what you would usually use. And we have a special one that we give you that's called the web HTTP relay binding. And the relay binding functions exactly like the web HTTP binding that they have in WCF, with the exception that you're not listening locally on your machine, but we listen for you in the cloud. And because of that, we also have this behavior where you now go and have the credentials for this. So I'm not going to... There you go. So that's how that you set that up. And then there are some configuration pieces here that I might explain in a moment. So let's take a look at the service. The service is the image service here, and that is actually very simple. Let's go and make this a little bigger so you can see. What it does is it reads an image file, caches that, and then whenever you call get image via this HTTP call, it goes and saves the bitmap to a memory stream and then returns that memory stream back to the client. right? And then so it sets an image JPEG. So it's a very plain HTTP web service that I'm building here. With the only change, with the only difference to normal WCF service being that it runs through the relay binding. So I have that running here. And because you should believe that I actually do that from here, I'm going to go and compile it again. I'm going to run it again. Of course, now it's not going to work. If it doesn't, I'm going to rip the cable out. Because it worked wonderful on the wireless network until I connected to this wired network. So we'll see how that's behaving. Because it should already. Yep. So, connectivity issue. Hang in there. I have great confidence that the service works. So I'm now pulling the cable out. And see whether it's better over the wireless. And if it's not, then I can soundly blame it on the network. There we go. So now what I've done is, through this network, let me just show you that. This is my machine has the power and the cable for the video, but otherwise it's just on the wireless network here that you are also on. I'm hosting a publicly accessible web service that anybody in the world can get to from this machine, right here, from this hall. That's what the relay does. So let's go and hit it. I'm going to go here and going to go pick this out. And you could do that as well if you were quick enough. Yes, take a picture. Okay. And I'm going to take a new window here. Let's go and get in here. Me. That's the picture. So, thank you. I've been showing this trick for 4 years. It never gets old. So that's what you can do. You can go and use effectively any internet connection you can find as long as it works, unlike this one, and effectively create an outbound tunnel, which we use as a tunnel for you to listen on. We support TCP-based connections. We support HTTP tunnels, so we can go actually get out through plain HTTP or with HTTPS. And we'll be as aggressive as we can. If that machine can see the internet, it can listen. And that's something that is absolutely fantastic. See, there's one hero who has it. So that's now there. Wonderful. Let me kill the app. Okay. So now the app is gone. Refresh. Yep. Gone. Can't get it anymore. Same thing we hear. All right. Refresh. Suddenly, I only get that feed. Service is gone. Shows that it's actually real. It's not a fake demo. He could get to it. And we don't know each other, don't we? No. Good. So this is kind of the typical magician trick of making sure that you don't know the other person. So you can expose effectively any web service from and to anywhere as long as it is built on WCF. For the time being, we will have support for web API in the near future. As I said, that support is done. We're just doing some polishing on it. So I expect this to be coming out in one of the releases this summer. And we're also working on something that's called the IIS Hybrid Cloud Bridge. That's also code that we have kind of in semi-ready form. I hope that we can get this out also this fall. Which is effectively a plugin to IIS that does all the things that I'm doing in that program automatically for you. So you can take any arbitrary IIS site and just host that as is on and through the relay. But for now, you can go and just use the relay for that capability. I'll have a slide on pricing a little later, and I'm going to explain the relay there as well, because that capability is cool but not free. From a programming model perspective, you have the web HTTP relay binding that you just saw. And then for applications that are using SOAP today, there's the basic HTTP relay binding, the WS2007 HTTP relay binding, and also NetTCP relay binding. And we are completely transparent to all the mechanisms that are in the WCF stack. So if you are using end-to-end security, if you're using message encryption, you can use that because we will never look at the messages that are flowing through. We look at the frames of the messages that are going through to route them, but we don't look at the content. You can prove that to yourself by just making a message encrypted communication link through service bus. There's some special bindings which allow one-way links and one that allows kind of broadcast like UDP does, where you can have up to 25 listeners on a single name. And those 25 listeners, you send one message in and all 25 get that. So this is super lightweight, pops up if you will, but without filtering. But that's if you want to go and broadcast the message. All of these bindings, the first four at least, have automatic load balancing built in. So you can go and listen on a name in service bus. So you listen on, you make a name inside of a namespace and you listen on that. You can have also up to 25 listeners hooked up to that same name. And if we get a new connection, we balance that by randomly to one of those listeners. So you can have a cluster sitting with the same name behind service bus, and we'll do the load balancing for you. The basic model is that the receiver goes out and makes a connection to service bus to one of our front-end nodes. And then the sender comes in, the client comes in, and connects up to a socket forwarder. We go and send a control message into our system, finding that receiver socket. The receiver then comes in and connects up to that socket forwarder, and that's how we have a connection, and that's how we shuttle the traffic back and forth. So it's all based on outbound traffic, and that's why we don't need to have an open firewall. We don't need to have any openings on the firewall. This works without any firewall configuration. As long as you can get out, the traffic can come back in. There's no inbound firewall rules required. That was the relay. There's one question. Let me hear it.
What's the latency?
What is the latency? The latency that you incur is effectively, it's mostly the internet latency for those connections. We're building a lower latency path right now, which allows you to get traffic on that control connection that I showed you, which will cut the latency by twice the time from here to the data center. Once you have a connection established, it's just internet latency from the client to the data center, from the data center to you. So it is more expensive, obviously, but it's for what is being used for, that latency is actually usually acceptable. You don't do real-time gaming over that. Messaging. Messaging is, in core, built on two artifacts that we have in the system. We have queues and we have topics. A queue is, to be fundamental, an ordered message log. So messages, it's a database, if you will. The messages go in there and they are ordered. And there's a number of features that are there, like they're ordered by arrival. So the broker, our system, is deciding who comes first. And it will go and timestamp them, and it will go and put a sequence number on them. The timestamping is interesting because with that, you now have an authoritative clock. So we run the clock for you, and if you are building a system that, for instance, does auctions, and you need to decide, you know, whether a bid came in before or after the time, but you don't have enough capacity to go and pull the data off, then you can go and use that authoritative clock to do that. The data is stored in SQL, and once we give you an acknowledgement that the message has been accepted, it is already persisted. So even though we do persistence for all the messages today, we can achieve in the cloud throughput rates of up to 3,000 messages per second on a queue on a good day. All right? On a good day. On a normal day, 1,500, 2,000. On a really good day, 3,000. If you're in this data center, if you're really close to the system, then you can actually achieve that kind of a throughput from multiple senders with multiple receivers, async. So there's some constraint there. We have two modes for delivering messages. One is pull, so you walk up to the queue and just say, give me a message, receive. Or we can actually forward, so we can make a queue, and you can send to another queue, and you can send to a topic, and I have a slide on that in detail later. A topic is like a queue, but it has multiple outs. So you can send messages in with the same protocol as a queue, and then you can make a subscription, which is a durable thing, which creates effectively a cursor over the message log, and you can go and make a filter on that cursor over the message log. So these subscriptions are independently created, they're durable, so they have a name and you can walk up to them, and they behave like queues, but they get their messages fed from that one input, which is the topic per se. You can have up to 2,000 concurrent subscriptions, which means if the rule on every single one of those subscriptions is true, yes, let all messages through, you can set one message in and you get 2,000 messages out in parallel to 2,000 different subscribers who can go and own those. And then there's rules. The rules I'm going to show you a little bit later. From the head and the tail of the topic are completely compatible with the queues, use the same protocols. To program against the messaging system, we have multiple options. On Windows, you can program with the messaging API. That's on the code that I have on the slides. This is going to be mostly about that. We also have support for WebCF. So there's a net messaging binding that ships with the service bus assembly that you can use, and that works mostly like the MSMQ binding. So if you are using the Windows Communication Foundation, you can use that binding, and you're automatically using service bus. So, and that works with the queues and the topics and the subscriptions. That sits on top of that, and the messaging API sit on top of a proprietary protocol that is what we call nickname SBMP. That is the current protocol that is the primary protocol for service bus. As of last week, we are now in production with AMQP 1.0. That's a brand new protocol that we're going to talk about more. And that is now becoming the standard protocol for service bus, and we hope that we can get this proprietary protocol out within the upcoming 12 months and then be completely just standards-based based on AMQP. We're also very serious about not only supporting Windows, but effectively anything that you might like. So you can run C, C++, Java, Python, PHP, Node, and any HTTP client. Currently, the shipping SDK for Python, PHP, and Node are using our HTTP head for Service Bus. We have a full RESTful API to manage, but also to receive and send messages. That API, those APIs will also move on top of AMQP. The management functions will still be on HTTP, but the message send and receive functionality will move over to AMQP because that's much more efficient for message passing than HTTP is. So the connectivity options are, as I said, AMQP, an OASIS standard. We have two ports that are there. We actually factually use the TCP port 5671. So if you want to connect out to Service Bus with AMQP, you have to have that port open for outbound traffic today. We are working in the AMQP standards organization, in the working group, to get a binding of AMQP on top of WebSockets. And once we have a model on top of WebSockets, we can also connect out to port 443, which means use the standard model. So we're working on this, and as soon as we have agreement in the standards body for this, then we're going to go and implement. We're not, probably not going to go and go ahead and do that by ourselves. So previous status, actually, that's no longer true. General availability happened last week, so that's now generally available. You can now use AMQP. Our service bus messaging protocol is using port 9354. For the relay, it's using the ports 9351, 2, and 3, in addition, and 4, in addition to that. No, 1, 2, and 3. So you need to have those ports available for outbound traffic. If you don't, we'll tunnel that protocol over HTTP and also over HTTPS, depending on what the connectivity is. So we're very aggressive over that. So a few more words on AMQP. It's 20 companies have worked together. AMQP is a very interesting story in terms of standards and how a standard has been formed, because it's a very unusual way how this worked. The companies that are on Wall Street in America, finance companies, are the heaviest users of message-oriented middleware, and they're mostly using software that was made by our dear competitors, IBM and TIBCO. IBM and TIBCO both have wonderful products that, however, don't embrace open standards all that much. Specifically, IBM MQ Series has been in the market forever, and the protocol is still proprietary and closed and is undocumented. So a number of Wall Street firms went out and said, hey, we are relying so much on messaging technology, we want to have this protocol open and interoperable. So the customer firms actually started this effort. JP Morgan Chase actually went and said, we need to have an open protocol, let's build one. And over time, there's a bigger set of companies, customer companies, as well as infrastructure companies, have joined this effort, and they came out together with the standard called AMQP. This has meanwhile been ratified as a standard in OASIS, and it's now moving on to standardization, ISO, IEC. So we're expecting that to be a world standard, effectively, in the coming years. So it's an open standard messaging protocol. It's reliable. What it does is enables reliable message passing. It is not specifically bound to a particular kind of messaging system, so it's not particular to a queue, and you can't create a queue through it. At least not with additional things that are laid on top, but it's a great way to go and connect systems. And also, it's a binary protocol, so it's not JSON, it's not XML, it's not none of those things. It is a super compact, low footprint, low wire footprint protocol that's specifically made so it's efficient on the wire for scenarios like in financial services where you have, you know, very, very tiny messages that you have to move at very high speeds. Again, it's no longer the preview. That slide is out of date. Sorry for including it. I missed that part. It's generally available as of last week. So, in Service Bus, we have a certain model of how we express messages. And that applies to AMQP as well as to our other protocol, as well as to also HTTP. So there's a common notion of how messages flow around. And that's something that's core to our system. You can send in a message over HTTP and you can pull it out using AMQP. You can send it in using our proprietary protocol. You can pull it out using AMQP. So we're negotiating protocol for you. Whatever your client speaks and whatever your server likes, right, you choose the appropriate protocol and we're bridging the protocols. And the reason why we can do that is because we have a canonical notion, a standard notion of messages. So we have effectively two sets of things. We have, three. We have system properties, which are controlling how the system behaves. So you can set, for instance, a TTL, a time to live, on a message, and you can set that to a minute. And if that message sits in the system for a minute, and nobody has fetched it, the message will go away. That's something you control over system properties. Custom properties are just key value pairs that you can set as you like. And then the body is the body of the message, whatever that is. The properties can have 64 kilobyte maximum, and the overall message can have 256 kilobyte maximum. What we find very often is that customers are using key value pairs only and not even using the message body. Also, don't confuse this with a SOAP message. The SOAP message would actually go completely into the body of this message. So these properties are, you can treat those properties as, you can use this message purely as a container for key value pairs, which makes it very nice and easy. There's three ways of delivering messages. One is just receive and delete. So you can use the API and say receive and delete. So you get a message, that message is being returned to you. As it's returned to you, it's immediately deleted at the broker. That's nice and fast, but you're risking of losing the messages if you fumble them on the way. Pclock is a way to go and take a message, get a lock on that message, take that message, and now you can go and work on it, and once you're done with that message, you say, complete. And only then the message gets deleted. If you crash, then the lock is going to expire and the message is going to show up again and you can go and process it again. So that's a more reliable way of dealing with that. And then there's a third option, which is sessions. And sessions is a way to take a lock on all messages that have the same session ID labeled on them. So with that, you can actually go and lock a sequence of messages, right, in order, so you can go and process that in order and reliably. And that also gives you demultiplexing in the system. There's two basic models for receive operations. One is a credit-based model. AMQP and SBMP are using this. And they are bidirectional protocols. So when you create a connection with the connection is created kind of by the API, and you say receive, we're taking that receive operation, which means you want one message, and we're sending that over to the broker. The broker will remember this, and if the connection stays idle for an hour, there's no polling happening. The broker still knows, the connection is still there, and the connection is being maintained with a ping message that's just there to service the connection, but there's no polling taking place. It's a super efficient way of doing this. If you're using HTTP, you have to remind the infrastructure every 60 seconds at least that you're still there. Because there's going to be a proxy, there's going to be a load balancer, there's going to be all kinds of things, and if you don't do any action on that socket, well, then the socket is going to be cut. So in HTTP, you need to do wrong polling, make a request, wait for a message to arrive. If no message arrives, you're going to do a re-request and a re-request, so you have traffic every minute. So HTTP is actually horrifyingly bad for any device that sits on battery. Because if it sits on battery, now you can't put the Wi-Fi chip into low gain because you keep waking it up. So HTTP is not a good protocol to do this, but the credit-based model is one that is actually more suitable for this, because if you come through a wireless network, you don't actually have to ping all that much. You have to ping probably every 20 minutes. So we're using that also for devices, battery-driven devices that are sitting on networks that are from wireless operators. Service pricing, before I go into patterns, 1 cent per 10,000 messages, one US cent, that will be something equivalent in rubles, 30-something. And the way this works is you send a message up to 64 kilobytes in size. That's one transaction. You get that message out again. That's also one transaction. If you're asking for a message and you get one, you don't get one back because your time had expired, that's also one message transactions. And every extra segment, data segment of 64 kilobyte also counts as a transaction. So if you send one message, 256K up, it's four times 64K, it's four transactions. If you pull that message down again, that is another four transactions. But at that price, you can also say $1 per a million transactions. That's nothing we can get rich over. That's also something we're very sad about. You have outbound Windows Azure traffic surcharges if you use this to go and bridge between different places. And those you're paying at the normal rate, they go on top of this. For the relay, this also applies. There's an extra charge of 10 cents per 100 hours that you are on the relay with an endpoint. Works out to 72 cents per month per endpoint. That's something that you also need to go in and put in addition to this. If you're exposing, this is the funny thing, we have a number of customers who are exposing critical corporate systems through the relay because they want to integrate them with cloud systems, and we sent them a bill for whatever, $10, $10 per month, and we're giving them an avenue to, you know, make millions of dollars, and so we're crying every day why we're charging so little. So now let's go in. So now we have the basic capabilities. Let's talk about some messaging patterns. Why would you want to use a queue? So first of all, load leveling. You get a lot of traffic from the sender, and the receiver only has so much capacity to go and process. What a queue in the middle does, it levels the load, because the receiver will go and get a message, process it, get the next message and process it, and get the next message and process it. It will do so on its own time. The sender can go and send bursts of data that will not disturb the receiver. The receiver will simply go and do this. So it's like a stack of files, or it's a queue. If there's more need than capacity, well, then that will not disturb the one who is working. But you can look at the length of the queue and add more capacity based on that. And if the queue is empty, then you can go and shrink the capacity based on that. So you can level, that's called load leveling. It makes the load the same, because you have this decoupling, this intermediary. Also, it's nice that the receiver can be offline completely. You can send to the queue, and the receiver can come in and be offline, maybe disconnected, or it's just completely shut down and only come up every now and then, which now then is equivalent to batch processing. So it's already very useful to have a queue for those purposes. Then it also gives you natural load balancing. You can have multiple receivers coming into a queue and receiving messages from it, and they're being served in order of arrival. So you send one message in, the first party gets it and works on it. Second message goes in, the second party goes and gets it and works on it. Third message goes in, third party gets it. Next message goes in, well, whoever is done with that work first comes in and gets the data. Very natural, true load balancing. If you think about load balancing on HTTP, that's not load balancing, that's traffic balancing. Right? You balance the traffic not really based on the load of the backend servers, but really based on the incoming traffic. Here, it's true load balancing. You are balancing the work based on the load that everybody has because of how many receive loops they're effectively running. There's fan in, so you have a model where you can go and use a queue if you have a large number of clients and they want to send you data, and they want to send you data in bursts, or they form bursts because they want to do that all at the same time. You can use a queue as a concentrator. So the queue takes all that traffic in, and your system doesn't need to scale up to that maximum size. We also have capabilities how we can go and scale this above the capacity of a single queue. I said a queue has a capacity on a good day of 3,000 messages a second, on the normal day, 2,000. If you need more than that, let's say you need 200,000 messages a second, which you might need depending on what the scenario is, well, you make 100 queues. And then you let those queues forward into fewer queues and one queue, so you can make an inbound tree, and with that, you can go and manage that traffic. If 200,000 devices sent you a message every hour on the hour, well, that's a lot of traffic you have to take within a minute, but you can go and process that later, so you can go and fan that under the tree. Then there's fan out. Subscriptions and topics are great for that. Send a message in, and you have N subscriptions, and you can go and send to each subscriber individually based on some filters, and you can also partition data based on this. So you have a message that comes in, the message has some number associated with it, and you decide that data for this customer gets stored in this partition. You can actually go and do that partitioning in that way with a subscription. Like here, there's a rule, a filter rule on this subscription here, which says if the name is like V, starts with V, then you're going to go and route through this subscription, and otherwise you're going to route through one of those subscriptions which then have a different condition. So everything that has my last name would actually go here. Up to 2,000 of these rules you can have per each subscription, and each of these rules yields a message copy. Partitioning, what I just mentioned, works like this. You can have effective mutually exclusive rules over the partition, over the subscriptions, and with that, you send a message in, and it pops out in a different subscription based on what your rules are. I'm going to skip correlation, and too much data, and not enough time. And we'll talk about the API a bit. How you send, this is the .NET API. As I said, we have 5 SDKs, we have PHP, and we have all the Python, all these other languages. I'm going to stick with .NET. So you create a queue client. We have a thing we call the connection string. Let me just show you how you get one. I'm here on my portal. That's my Windows Azure portal. And with my things that I have, and so I'm going to go and go to a Service Bus namespace that I own. That's my Service Bus namespace. And now is the good time to take a picture. So it now connects to my namespace and it gives me a key. I think. Oh no, it will not give me a key. See that magic sign here in the corner? The magic sign means you have an internet connection. Well, anyways, that was the right place to go to, and it will now show me a string. The good part about this failure is that I now don't have to change my key because I didn't show it to you. So it will give you a connection string. That connection string you can put into your configuration file, or you can actually go and put it right into that function. And that's mostly like SQL. And so you create a client for the queue, and then on the queue you can go and send. Since the 2.0 SDK, we also have the full set of async task-based functions, so you can also do send async, or you can use the async result-based model, you can use begin and end. And I would implore you, please, don't do what I do here, always use async. Always use async, please. Async is the best thing you can do for your life. Async is awesome. Use async. Never use anything synchronous on the server. Use async. It's much better for you. Also makes better skin. So the way you formulate a message is you create a new one with brokered message, and then you can either set some built-in properties like label or time to live, or you can just make up your own properties, as I showed you in that model, or key-value pairs. You basically just go and set them up in that dictionary, and then you can go and send them. So here is a message that I'm creating, and it has no body whatsoever. It's just key-value pairs. And this is actually a very reasonable way to deal with this. You can send this through .NET, and you can pull this out on Java. So they're fully interoperable, those messages that you create, because we're not shipping types. We're preferring to ship key-value pairs, and we have a type system that's built on top of AMQP. Receiving messages, just as easy. Create the client from a connection string, and then you can go and receive, and these are the one on top is the receive and delete mode. You basically receive, you get the message out. And the lower one is the peak lock mode, where you receive, and once you have processed the message, you go and complete it, and if you have an error in that, you go and abandon it. And the message gets automatically abandoned after some time. Default is 2 minutes. And then the message gets returned to the queue if you crash, for instance. You can go and adjust that time on the portal or in the API for any individual queue. The subscription filters are expressed like this. They have there's an expression language that is there. It's not very rich, but it's close to what you will find in SQL as expressions. We just don't have as many functions available there. And then there's also actions. If you have a condition, you can also set a function based on that. And I'm now over time, just telling you, so I'm going to go 5 minutes over that for the people on the video. So I'm going to go show you this. In addition to that, auto-forwarding. That's the feature you can go and set. You can go and set the forward to on a queue. And with that, the message automatically gets forwarded into another queue. The reason why you would want to do this is actually shown in, up here. You can, first of all, make location transparency. You can have a topic that does something. You can have a queue that's an inbound queue for a particular application. And you can retarget that queue to something else. So you can effectively use a queue as a proxy into your system. That's one thing. The second thing is you can make this fan-out tree that if a topic has a subscription, automatically forwards into another topic. So you can make a tree to fan out, and as I explained earlier, you can also make a tree for fan in with these trees of queues. So that's something you can do with forward too. Last topic, hot one, notification hubs. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, unfortunately, because of time. Notification hubs are for push notifications. The reason why you want to use push notifications in your phone application is because you want to remind customers that your phone application is actually still there. So you send information about current news, about sports results, about what's happening with your friends. And I'm sure everybody who has a phone knows those things. They show up as tiles in Windows. They show up as posts on iOS and on Android. And you can also set these badges on the icons in iOS. So they're a very cool thing. Usually, the way this works is that the client application talks to this push platform notification service, Apple Push Notification Services. And the application backend, then it gets some code, and then the client application talks to the application backend to send the to send the data there. So let me do that again. So the application starts, it goes to the push notification service, gets a ID, comes back, goes now to the application backend web service, says this is the ID, and whenever an event occurs, the application platform service goes and sends that to the platform notification service, which sends it to the phone. The problem, one of the problems here is that, of course, you now have to write that application backend service. You have to write the thing that scales to however many 100,000. And if you are building an application for, let's say, a big sports event, there's one coming up here in Russia, I've heard, then doing that is very difficult because you might have an audience of 10 million people or 50 million people, and you want to send the fact that someone has won the gold medal within very short time. You don't do that with a for loop. That's something that is much more involved. So what we're building is the notification hubs that are doing that. So the notification hub is a one-time setup. You create one just as you create a queue in the portal. There's an SDK that you can go and we have one for Android, for iOS, and for a Windows Phone, and for Windows. The Android and the Windows Phone is still not released, but we're making them, and we will release them very, very soon. So we're going to have all four platforms. And what you'll do there is you do a gesture to register with a push notification system, but then instead of talking to your own backend, you talk to us. And we're dealing with all that registration for you. We're dealing with notifications about the device being dead, and we're blacklisting it. We're dealing with, in fact, we're doing all the management of the notifications for you. And what you need to do to target 5 million devices with messages is you need to send us one message. One message, and we make 5 million messages out of that. And we're doing that in minimal time. We can't, now, we're not magicians.